No matter what you're a fan of, Texas has the trip for you. There's the trip to Texas and the trip. Or maybe you're the kind of fan who'd prefer a trip to Texas or a trip. Either way, go to TravelTexas.com/get your own for the only trip to Texas that matters. Yours.
Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.
Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. When you go on vacation, you probably travel to places to help you feel good, relax, and have fun. My guest today, well, he likes to visit places where great human suffering and tragedy has occurred. His name is Thomas Cook. He's a writer of crime fiction, but in his latest book, Even Darkness Sings, he takes readers with him on the real family trips he's taken to see humanity's darkest places, including Auschwitz, Verdun, and Hiroshima. We begin a conversation discussing how Thomas and his wife got the idea to visit dark places, how all dark places are different yet connected, and how darkness has unique power to offer insight and even hope and optimism. Tom then takes us on a tour of some of the tragic places he's visited and the lessons he learned from them. We end our conversation discussing the importance of treating dark places with somber reverence and how a personal dark place was created for Tom while he was writing this book. After the show's over, check out our show notes at aom.is/darkness. Thomas joins me now via clearcast.io. All right, Thomas Cook, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you wrote a book, Even Darkness Sings. It's about your travels. Now, what's interesting about your travels, a lot of people, you know, they pick themes for their travel. And I've known folks that have visited World War II sites, Civil War sites, homes of famous authors, places where Hemingway lived. You and your late wife decided to visit dark places. Now, before we get there, how did you guys define a dark place and what drew you to visiting those types of places?
Well, I think that we had, I knew, especially given the fact that it occurred to me at one point that this would be a book, was that we had to define dark places in various ways. You couldn't just go from one concentration camp or one battlefield to another. You had to define the kinds of darkness that exist in life. And so, of course, you had the celebrity sites, you might call them, of dark places like Auschwitz and Ravensbrück and Verdun. But I also wanted to visit places where there had been, for example, a romantic tragedy or a medical tragedy or a natural disaster or a political tragedy that did not involve necessarily atrocities, but was a tragedy. So I just came up with various kinds of places that I wanted to go. And in a sense, also just in my travels, they began to define themselves. And these places sort of began to speak to me in tragic ways that you wouldn't necessarily notice if you didn't sort of have that broader understanding of what human tragedy is in your mind.
And, I mean, what drew you to that? I mean, did you visit, like, there was a dark place you visited and you saw something there that maybe I want to go see more of this?
I think it was really the moment that it really began to occur to me, the value of all of this, was when I was in Italy with my daughter. We had been living in Spain, and we rented a car every summer. She went to the American School of Madrid. She was 12 years old. And we would rent a car every summer. She had 6 years off and travel all around Europe. We also went to North Africa and other places like that. We were in Cosenza, a little town, a dreary, actually, little town in Italy. And we'd been driving all day, and she was 12 years old, and we'd been going to museums, what she called broken pot museums. And we were on this river, and Susan had this incredible ability to take a 10-minute nap and be completely refreshed. So during that time, Justine and I would go out and we would play a game of hearts or rummy or something like that. But we were on this river, and I could tell, you know, it was the end of the day. It was extremely hot in Italy. She was very tired. And we were looking at the river, the little Busetto River. And I said, you know, this is where Alaric died. And she didn't know who Alaric was, but she asked. And I said, well, he was the last pagan emperor of Rome. And that sort of sparked a little bit of interest, not much, but a little. And then I said, you know, when he died here, they wanted to keep his birthplace secret, so they rerouted the river. They had hundreds of slaves who rerouted the river. And then they buried him in that river. And then they brought the river back to the channel, all of which is true, so that no one would ever know where he was buried. And that sparked yet more interest. And I could see the river looked a little bit different to her now. Something had happened. And then I said, and when it was over, they slaughtered all of the slaves who had buried Alaric so that none of them could tell where he lay. And I saw something different come into her eyes. Suddenly, this was a place, something very, very dark had happened. And there was just more, a kind of intellectual passion for that place that wouldn't have been there otherwise. And it struck me then, in a child 12 years old, that this was a good thing to do, a place to not just Disneyland or Six Flags, or to take your kids to places like this from time to time. And I always say, Brett, that, you know, it's fine to take your kids to Disneyland and Six Flags and other places. I've done that. We went to Disneyland. We went to great fairs. We've gone to amusement parks in Barcelona, throughout the world. But from time to time, you know, you might want to go to a dark place and have a different kind of conversation with your children.
Yeah. And what's interesting, these dark places, the places you went to, you know, human atrocities occurred, tragedies occurred. But the theme that comes up over and over again in your book is that these dark places can bring light. They can sing. They can give insights about life. But they do so obliquely. It's like, it's not direct, right? It's not like you get hammered in the head with it, but it happens maybe a few days or months after you leave the place. So I'm curious, like, over the time you've been doing this, what are some of the sort of general themes or life lessons you've gotten from visiting these places?
I think, you know, I say in the book at one point that dark places speak to each other. And in a way, it works. Like, if you go to one dark place after another, certain lessons occur that really are germane to all of those lessons, all of those places, and come out of that experience. And so that the lessons are compounded. And I remember particularly at Auschwitz, we had gone there and spent the day there, and it was very dark, and there was nothing really about Auschwitz that you could find in any really redeeming way. So you really don't look for that, although there were acts of great courage and at Auschwitz and great goodness that happened there as well among individuals. But what happened once I left Auschwitz was that I remembered the trip there, and we had left Budapest that morning, believing that we would be in Krakow by 4 p.m, but the roads were very bad. The signage was awful. I would have to get out and talk to these German bus drivers in these big buses. And, you know, my German isn't very good. And their directions were always immerdirekte, which means straight on. But then you'd get to a fork in the road. Okay, straight on which way? Like, you know, left or right. So as we got sort of bumblingly closer to the Polish border, it was getting very, very late. It was after midnight. And we finally reached the Polish border at around 3 a.m. And these three guards came out. And I'll say now, it was a little suspicious because they were all wearing different parts of a single uniform. I mean, this was really right. Glasnost had not approached this place. It was right out of Jean Le Carré. And they began to talk to me in Polish, and they wouldn't let me in Poland, even though I had, passports and everything like that. They kept asking for something, and I didn't speak a word of Polish. But they kept asking, and they kept asking, and I thought, okay, I'm going to have to turn back and go to Budapest. They're not going to let me in at this border crossing. And then all of a sudden, I heard this voice. It was absolutely angelic. This voice said, "May I be of assistance, sir?" And I turned around, and there was a guy named Siggy who had lived in the United States, but his wife wanted to come back to Krakow. They were on their way to Krakow as well. He negotiated everything for me, and got me across the border. And I thought that was just an act of human kindness that was absolutely wonderful. But that man would not have been able to do that if I were a Jew fleeing Poland in 1944 or 1943. He would not have been able to do that. And the lesson there was one that really, before tyranny comes, that's when you act against it. Because once tyranny is in place, it takes superhuman courage to oppose it. You can oppose Hitler before he's a complete autocrat, but you can't oppose him after unless you are truly, truly, truly courageous. And so I guess my lesson there was that it's sort of a moral responsibility to be wise, to know that you have to begin to foresee what's liable to happen, what are the consequences of certain kinds of political decisions, and to look forward as much as you can. And that happened again and again to me in places that if people could have just taken a moment and thought and tried to really figure out what the consequences of their actions are going to be. And we're not perfect in that, you know. Obviously, you know, the rearview mirror is perfectly clear. But at least try. And then maybe we can prevent some of these things in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's how one way dark places, you know, are connected and they talk to each other. Because a lot of these things and these tragedies happen, you know, people really didn't see it coming or they weren't paying attention.
That's exactly right. I mean, the Austrians voted for Anschluss. We keep forgetting that Hitler was elected by the German people. And it's when you see the steps toward authoritarianism before authority has completely instilled itself, embedded in itself in the political process, then you have a chance to stop it. But you have to really look ahead. You know, there's a wonderful letter to Lenin. I've often quoted it to my more left-wing friends, and it is a letter that said, if a government is dominated by one party, it will finally be dominated by one committee within that party, and it will finally be dominated by one man within that committee. And that was a letter written of warning, written by Rosa Luxemburg to Nikolai Lenin before the Communist Revolution became Stalinist, you might say.
Right. Well, let's take a little visit of some of these dark places you visited throughout, you know, writing this book and throughout your life. I mean, you start off with this really poignant scene with the book. It's the Spanish Civil War. Colonel Jose Moscardo, he was the leader of the Nationalist Army. Mm-hmm. He was in a fort called Alcazar and he gets a phone call. And you went to go visit this fort and you got to see this phone.
Yes.
What happened during that phone call that he got?
This was the Alcazar, which is really the military academy, the West Point of Spain. And if you go to Toledo, Toledo is built on a hill. And the Alcazar just dominates that hill. And he was in charge of the fascist forces, Franco's forces there. The Republicans had captured his son, who was 17 years old, I believe, named Louis. And they called him and they told him that they had his son. And that if he did not surrender the Alcazar, they would execute him. So on the pretext of wanting to make sure that this was his son, Colonel Moscardo asked to speak to Louis. And Louis came on the phone and they talked for a little while. And then Colonel Moscardo said to him, prepare to die, my son. And when I saw that, I saw it in a film called To Die in Madrid, a documentary about the Spanish Civil War. I just had this incredible impulse to see that phone, to go to the Alcazar and see that phone. It took me years to do it. I was already married by then, so I went with Susan and I went with Justine. But I did see that phone, and they still have it there. It's part of and the room is completely preserved, except they've now put up portraits of Louis and Colonel Moscardo. But it has entered sort of the legend of the Spanish Civil War. And it makes you, what happened there, to me, was that I went out on the Esplanade outside that and for some reason began to think of my own father. And that's what really gave me the notion that these dark places sort of unmoor you and they let you think about your own life. And it's a really intimate kind of moment in which you share with yourself your own past and the past of mankind. And all of that sort of comes together in those moments if you just let your mind go free.
What insights about your father did that experience give you?
Well, my father and I did not have a lot in common. He was a very sweet man, a very, very kind man, but we did not have a lot in common. But we did have one thing in common. He liked to go to weird places. He liked to go where there were floods, where a tornado, we were in the South. I was brought up in the Appalachian foothills of Fort Payne, Alabama. And we would go to places where tornadoes had ripped up a barn or unearthed a tree, or they'd have these sleet storms. And he would love to go out and see the sleet storms where the power lines had been torn down. He was just tremendously attracted to the sort of the topsy-turvy, the things that looked weird. And I realized that I probably, although I didn't think that I had a lot in common with him, I had that in common with him. And it was huge. It was a very deep kind of connection that we had. He would always take me with him. And we had our greatest moments doing that when I was growing up as a little boy. And I suddenly realized that, how much he meant to me, because I had not thought of my father, very much other than in ordinary ways in a long time. And suddenly, though, at the Alcazar, he really came roaring back into my heart.
Now, I loved how you said that visiting places unmoor you, like they disorient you. It sounds almost like they're like physical tragedies, right? Like geographic tragedies, like the tragic place from ancient Greece, where they did the same thing. That sort of disoriented you, got you thinking about things. You experienced a catharsis, and it helped you think about things that you probably otherwise wouldn't think about.
That's exactly right. It because you're not distracted by rides and attractions and all that sort of thing, and your mind is really can become a little bit unfocused even on the place that you're at. It allows you just simply to make connections with your own life so that history connects with you and your most intimate aspects of your life. And it's an incredibly powerful experience sometimes.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. It's wedding season, and while weddings are all about the bride and groom, they're also a chance for you to look your best. With a fully custom suit from Indochino, you'll walk into wedding season looking like $1 million, even though suits start at just $499. It's easier than ever to be the best dressed with Indochino. Order your custom suits now and they'll be ready for wedding season. The process of customizing a suit on Indochino, very easy to do. It's also a lot of fun. I've talked about my navy blue suit I've gotten from Indochino. First off, you can decide how the jacket is, how you want the pockets on the jacket to be, how you want the lapels, the vent on the back, the lining on the pants. You can decide you want pleats or no pleats. I went no pleats on my pants on this one. And then you do the measuring process. You'll need someone to help you, but they have this very easy to follow guide. Send that all in a few weeks, you have a custom made-to-measure suit sent directly to your door, and you're going to pay about the same price for a suit that you'd pay for an off-the-rack suit at a department store. Look your best this wedding season at the table or on the dance floor when you wear Indochino. Go to Indochino.com today and use code MANLINESS to get 10% off any purchase of $399 or more. That's Indochino.com, promo code MANLINESS. Check it out today. If you're like me, you've probably signed up for subscription services, but then you forgot about them. I'm talking about newsletters, streaming services, things like that. Well, with the personal finance app Rocket Money, it can help you find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions. It can also monitor your spending and help you lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. I had a chance to use Rocket Money, connected it to my checking account, and it found a bunch of subscription services that I forgot about. I was able to cancel them, and I was able to save a lot of money because the stuff adds up. Besides canceling your unwanted subscriptions, Rocket Money will even try to negotiate lower bills for you, up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. They'll deal with customer service for you. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/manliness. That's rocketmoney.com/manliness. rocketmoney.com/manliness. Have you ever been to an event where you just had to get the best seats? Like maybe it was a concert for your favorite band, or maybe it was an important game for your favorite team. Well, to do that, you had to set an alarm to get the tickets as soon as they went on sale. When you want the best, you have to act quickly, or someone else will get it instead. It's like if you are trying to hire for your business and you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. So what's the best way to do that? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast, and right now you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best people fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/manliness. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/manliness, M-A-N-L-I-N-E-S-S. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, picture that thing you've always wanted to learn. Now picture learning it from the person who's literally the best at it in the world. That's what you get with Masterclass. This year, learn from the best to become your best with Masterclass. Masterclass offers over 180 world-class instructors, and a lot of them are former AOM podcast guests. So for example, you can learn The Art of Negotiation from Chris Voss. We had him on the podcast. Leadership from Jocko Willink, another AOM podcast guest. Writing from Malcolm Gladwell, another AOM podcast guest. You name it, Masterclass has it. With Masterclass, you get unlimited access to intimate one-on-one classes with the world's best. Plus, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's no risk. So I did the Masterclass with Chris Voss on negotiation. Very well done. He talks about tactical empathy, how to mirror somebody so that you can develop rapport with them. So if you enjoyed that podcast I did with Chris Voss several years ago about his book, Never Split the Difference, you're going to love this Masterclass. And right now, AOM listeners will get an additional 15% off an annual membership at masterclass.com/AOM. Get 15% off right now at masterclass.com/AOM. Masterclass.com/AOM. Check out the negotiation class with Chris Voss. And now back to the show. As you said earlier, you know, you visited some of the really big places like Auschwitz and Hiroshima, but some of my favorite sections were like on the places that at first blush they don't look like dark places. And one of those is a place called Lourdes in France. Tell us about that and why is it a dark place?
Lourdes is in the Pyrenees. And it's a very famous place of Catholic pilgrimage. It's based on this young woman, Bernadette, who really didn't even speak French because that part of France was really sort of not really France. It was nationally, but the people there really didn't speak French. She saw a vision in a grotto there, a little rock cave. It was a very, very poor area. And over time, this grotto became a very famous place of pilgrimage. If you go there now, and I was again there recently, it's very honky tonk. I mean, it's a huge tourist attraction. They bring in big buses and all that sort of thing because it is so famous, Lourdes. And we spent the day there and the night, and it was a dark place only because it seemed to me that they had commercialized an element of faith in an extremely garish way. I mean, they have statues of Mary that are really a water bottle where you knock off her crown and pour water in it. I mean, it's very, very vulgar, with almost like it was an Elvis Presley shrine. I mean, it's really awful. And we were about to leave, and then the night procession began. And it was so extraordinarily beautiful that it just simply washed away all of the ill feeling and disappointment that I had at Lourdes, and my wife and my daughter as well, because the procession is of people who are deathly ill, and you see wheelchairs and you see people in hospital beds, and they're being pushed by family members or sometimes by hospital staff or by nuns. And in many cases, you can tell by the threadbare clothes they wear that this trip to Lourdes is the only trip they've ever made. And they've made it there because they are in desperate straits. And I saw that a dark place can really overcome almost everything that's done to make it less dark. It can overcome even the commercialism around it. And that made Lourdes very powerful, and in its darkness, very bright.
Another interesting thing that you do throughout the book is you have these little snapshots. They're little vignettes of dark places popping up almost spontaneously during your travels where you least expected it. For example, you found a dark place unexpectedly while you were in Fiji, which is, you know, that's a prime vacation destination for most Westerners. What dark place did you find there, and what insight did you get from it?
Well, you're right. That was completely unexpected. I mean, Susan and I and Justine, we always believed in traveling on public transportation if we could, not in tourist buses. We never went on tours or anything like that. And there's a wonderful line from a travel writer that says, life is best seen in a third-class carriage. And I found that really is true. So we were taking a bus into, I believe the town was called Nadi, a little town in Fiji, because Fiji is basically divided between the way people actually live in the towns and the villages and these huge resorts. And for the tourists, the buses just take you from resort to resort. You don't ever have to really go into the real Fiji. But we were on the bus going in there, and this man sat down next to me. Very, very friendly man. He was very, very large. He had lived in England, and he said to me, "Did you know that Fijians are good bouncers?" And I said, "No." He said, "Oh, yes, they employ us a great deal in Britain and other places because we're very big, but we're very nice." And we had a really nice conversation. He was a very lovely man. And I was thinking of the book at that time, and I said, "What do you think's the worst thing that ever the worst thing that ever happened to Fiji?" And he said, "The British leaving, because they would never have allowed Fiji to become the way it is." And Fiji is, in fact, a police state. And I thought, how sad to be a person who lives in an island indigenously. This is his island. And to think that it takes foreigners to impose kind of the rule of law upon you. That may or may not be true, but that's how he felt. And I thought that was extremely, extremely sad.
I mean, did you see any hope there with these guys, or was it just sort of just, man, this is really sad? And it just kind of speaks to the human condition that sometimes life, you're born in the wrong country or you're born in the wrong time, whatever.
Well, I don't think there's any question but that people are, you're just simply born in the wrong time, and history just rolls over you. There's an incredibly poignant scene that happened at a killing field in Poland. And it's actually photographed. You can actually see the video. But I was reading about it in Joachim Fest's book, A Biography of Hitler. And they had dug a ditch. They had dug a big ditch, and they were running people naked. They had taken off all their clothes. They were running people naked into that ditch to be shot. And they would run the one group in, and the other group would run over that group. And he talks about a girl who is running nakedly toward that ditch. And as she runs, she points to herself. And she says, 17, 17, meaning that she was going to die at 17. And that was the most poignant thing she could say at that moment. And that for me has always been the symbol of history just simply rolling over you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Man, that's haunting. It's really, really haunting. So another place you visited was the World War I place, Verdun in France. Can you describe the darkness that took place there?
Verdun is generally regarded as the worst battlefield experience ever experienced by soldiers anywhere. It was called the meat grinder. It was designed to be that. In a Christmas memo, a general had said that in order to distract the French and bleed them away from the Western Front, they would create a kind of Eastern Front and bleed the French army white. That's exactly what was said in that Christmas memo. And so it was always designed to be an absolute killing field. And when you go there, you really see just what a killing field it is. It's one of the places where the landscape has actually taken on what happened there, because most of the wounds that were suffered by soldiers during Verdun, they were concussion wounds. They were not bullet wounds. Or bayonet wounds. They were concussion wounds by mortars and high explosives. So they were literally blown to bits. So the mortars would hit, and they would blow up the earth and pile the earth up, and then blow up another one in a pit and blow it up. So when you look at the landscape around Verdun, it's very, very jagged, because some trees since then have grown up at the bottom of those pits, while others have grown up at the top of those pits. And so the whole landscape is sort of jagged. And what you see is a part of the earth that has simply not recovered from what happened there. And the slaughter was really quite unbelievable. I mean, I remember reading that the average lifespan of a first lieutenant there was about 6 weeks, of another soldier about a month. But the trip to Verdun really also sort of gave me a metaphor for what I was doing, because we left Paris heading for Verdun in a rented car. And you go down what the French call the Sacré Voie, which is the sacred road, the road down which the flower of French youth went in trains and buses and even taxicabs to the battle site of Verdun. It's now a highway, and French highways are very, very good. They're very, very clean. They're very well maintained. And you just zip down that highway. And all the way, you see these huge posters for Disneyland, because Disneyland France is the most visited place in France. It is extremely popular. And you see all of these people going to Disneyland, and you see these children and these teenagers. And I thought, yes, it's, you know, to repeat it, yes, it's fine to take your kids there. But if you go just a little further down the road after that, or next year, you get to Verdun. And you can have a wonderful experience there with your family as well, by walking the battlefield, by talking about the war, by seeing the films, by giving them a sense of what other people suffered who didn't have the chance to go to Disneyland and never will.
But you also, speaking of young people, you had an insight there while you were in your visit, because there was a group of, I think, German high schoolers taking a tour with their school. And they were kind of just joking and jostling around. It's like they didn't recognize the dark place for what it is. Did that happen a lot during your travels? Like, you'd go someplace where something really terrible happened and people just, they didn't really connect with that?
Well, in some places, yes, and in some places, no. Some places have taken a step in creating a more somber atmosphere than just simply letting people wander about. For example, in the Killing Fields, there's a sign before you enter in Cambodia. There's a sign before you enter the Killing Fields that tells you that you should not smoke, you should not play radios, you should not look at your phone. In other words, you should take a moment and be somber, because this is a place of great tragedy. At Auschwitz, there's a huge sign right before you know that famous Arbeit macht frei that you go under. There's a very big sign in many languages that says that this is a place of great suffering. You should comport yourself in such a way as to respect the suffering that was inflicted upon people here. And that does actually work. And I also noticed that at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, the light is very low. It's not a brightly lit museum. And that adds also to a somberness. So when places really do attempt to give you a sense of the somberness of it, it can really be effective. At Verdun, there's not much of an attempt to do that. And they have a little shop where you can buy things and, you know, touristy things, bracelets with your name on it and that sort of thing. But Verdun is very large, so people are all over. And this group of German kids, they were just jumping around and leaping around. They looked like they were like 14 or 15 years old. And I got sort of irritated about it. It sort of seemed to me they shouldn't be behaving in this way. And there is a very large ossuary there, and this is where they keep the bones of the fallen of Verdun. And as we were leaving, I could look up at the tower and everything and see those bones. And the German bus was pulling away with all the kids in it, and they were frolicking and everything. And I said to my wife, you know, really, this was wasted on them. And she said, well, I think you may be a little bit more intolerant than the people whose bones are in the tower. Because if they could look down and see these kids frolicking and having a good time, they might think, well, I'm glad they can. I'm glad they have their lives. We don't. And she was probably right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure some of those bones in there were probably 14, 15 years old.
Yes.
Right. They'd rather be those kids. They'd do the same thing. And speaking of going to that point of places trying to make it somber and, you know, let people know this is a place where tragedy occurred, you also talk about how they can go too far. And it can actually backfire and like sort of eliminate the feeling and of, I guess, reverence is the right word, or respect. Mm-hmm. I think there's one example you gave, like there's some medieval castle where they, you know, they depicted, you know, people getting boiled alive. And it sort of, I don't know, they were trying to like really hit home the idea that something bad happened here, but it actually backfired and people kind of thought it was funny.
Yeah, there are a few places that really, really are bad. They are not good at evoking even remotely what happened there. I think chief among those is the Tower of London, which is a very dark place. You know, people have starved to death there. The executions that were carried out there were awful. And Thomas Macaulay actually called the Royal Chapel inside the Tower of London, the saddest place on earth. So he certainly must have felt something very, very deep there. But when you go there now, it's, you know, they're selling beef. Everybody's in a beef eater costume. They're selling candy. They're selling tea. They have these big glass booths at extravagant prices. You go into the Tower of London and they've turned it into a sort of prison Disneyland. Another place where they fail is Phokoc, which is a prison in an island in the Bay of Thailand, which was a South Vietnamese prison where North Vietnamese soldiers were kept. And they have these sort of papier-mâché figures that are carrying out torture and everything. And they have the tiger cages, and they put papier-mâché figures in there, life-size papier-mâché figures. And what you see is people putting cigarettes in those people's mouths and in the papier-mâché figures' mouths, frolicking around, joking. They had a human-sized sort of frying pan, and they have soldiers putting a man in that frying pan. And, you know, some people near me, most of them were Vietnamese. I didn't see any Westerners there. You know, they're going, wow, ow, 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 and just sort of joking around and stuff like that. So places have to be aware of how they display themselves. And if they are going to evoke sort of frivolity in human beings rather than somberness, then they should find another way to display it. It's quite different in Toh Sling in Cambodia, which is the torture center there during the Khmer Rouge. And there, they've just left it exactly as it is, with the torture implements out, with the wire beds out. And you walk from room to room, and it's very, very somber. And you really get a sense of what people suffered there, which you don't get at Phokoc.
When you were doing these travels, and you know, some places you visited, people would ask you, like, why are you here, right? Like, I mean, when you told people, like, what you were doing, like, what were the responses when you told them, well, I'm visiting dark places?
Well, I mean, I think often what happened, which surprised me, was that they suddenly told me about a dark place they had gone. And I could tell that they were very moved by that place. But they were not inclined necessarily to go to another one. And what I was trying to teach is that, you know, you really can go from one to the other, not in sort of some sort of parade through the history of horror, but as a moving experience for your own emotional life. And I could tell that from time to time, people really did respond to that in the very individual ways of the things that they had seen and the places they had been.
In the course of writing this book, your wife died of cancer. Did that create a personal dark place for you, like a location where, like, that's now a dark place?
Well, I think, yes. When, you know, I recently went into the room where she died because the apartment was being sold. And of course, you feel that. But I think her death, she died at 62 of metastatic breast cancer. And I guess what that taught me was that sort of the task of life is to outrun regret. And it's hard to do, but that is our task. And Susan's great love was travel. And even though at 62 dying, I'm sure she felt like cheated out of a great deal of life. She never got to see her grandchildren, for example, which was very, very sad to me. But we had done so much. And since her great love was travel and she had done so much of it, I thought how much more she would have felt cheated if we had waited to when we retired, or waited when it would have been easier, or waited to when we had more money, how much more cheated she would have felt had we not done so many of the things that we really, really wanted to do. And since then, I'm older now. I'm 71 years old. And so, you know, I've seen people who have waited to retire, and then all of a sudden someone has a stroke or something else happens, and they'd never get to do the things that they sort of dream of doing only later. Now, I'm certainly aware that, you know, you have to have a little money, but it's also how you choose to spend your vacations and everything like that. And this was what she wanted. She got a great deal of it before she died. And if there's any, if I feel any sort of recompense with regard to her, it is that she actually did have great experiences in her life, even though it was taken from her way too soon.
And we literally scratched the surface. There's so many places you talk about in the book, and you even give at the end an itinerary of dark places that you'd like to visit. But where can people go to learn more about the book and your work?
Well, the book is, of course, available, in bookstores and in Amazon, and they can buy the book. It's also available on Kindle digitally, and they can buy the book, and they can see if there are any of those places appeal to them. They might want to go, and they can also look at the itinerary of places that, if I lived forever, I would visit, because I believe that this has been so infinitely valuable an experience that I would like to continue it as long as I can. And the even greater lesson, I think, is that my daughter wants to do this for her children. She considers it an extremely valuable experience that she had as growing up. And she is bent upon, with her two children and her husband, repeating these voyages with their children, because she just considers it an absolutely unforgettable experience that deepened her and made her a citizen of the world rather than just a citizen of one country or one state.
Thomas, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me, Brad. I really appreciate the opportunity.
My guest today was Thomas Cook. He's the author of the book, Even Darkness Sings. It's available on Amazon.com and bookstores everywhere. Also, check out our show notes at aom.is/darkness, where you can find links to resources where you can delve deeper into this topic. Well, that wraps up another edition of the AOM podcast. Check out our website, artofmanliness.com, where you can find thousands of articles on just about anything, personal finance, physical fitness, relationships. Also, you can check out our podcast archives there as well. And if you haven't done so already, I'd appreciate it if you take 1 minute to give us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps out a lot. And if you've done that already, thank you. Please consider sharing the show with a friend or family member who you think would get something out of it. As always, thank you for your continued support. Until next time, this is Brett McKay, reminding you not only listen to the AOM podcast, but to put what you've heard into action.
No matter what you're a fan of, Texas has the trip for you. There's the trip to Texas and the trip. Or maybe you're the kind of fan who'd prefer a trip to Texas or a trip. Either way, go to TravelTexas.com/get your own for the only trip to Texas that matters. Yours.
Travel is great, but planning for travel can be time-consuming and difficult. That's where One Travel comes in. With One Travel, you'll find everything you need to book the perfect trip. Flights, hotels, cars, transportation, it's all right there. With One Travel, you can book online, via app, or even pick up the phone and talk to a travel advisor ready to help you make your selections. Visit onetravel.com/music or call 855-437-2154. Plan it, book it, live it. One Travel.